impossible to be well hidden under my loose Russian garb. There was something overwhelming about the sheer size of the team. 16 proud ponies tethered to one chariot, and how many ponies might there be in all?
"Now, this is the king's own team," said Alexei. "That's why you see the gold and scarlet everywhere, because these are the court's colors."
"This is exquisite work," I said. "I've never even imagined anything like it." It was painted as well as carved leather, much of it. But why the blinders for all except the first row?
"These are the king's favorites,"
said the captain, as Prince Alexei deferred to him for the answer.
"They don't need blinders to calm them down. This is Caspian, Bastion, Throck, and Carnell. They are always at the front of the king's team, and well-experienced already and eager and frisky."
As I expected, the ponies gloried silently in this praise, tossing their heads, making tiny gold bells all along their harnesses jingle, and shifting in their harnesses, not struggling, no, but shifting and leaning on one horseshoed boot and then the other. I could hear the horseshoes striking the stones. There wasn't a tear on any of the faces of these four mounts, and they stared straight forward. Only Throck, the darkest of all with his golden brown hair, looked faintly bored, eyes roving the blue sky overhead, but he was essentially expressionless. Slowly, unable to resist, I walked back and forth in front of them and studied them one by one. Their calf and thigh muscles were powerful. I remembered that, the sheer strength I developed as a pony. The captain had thought it such a crude debasement when he'd brought me to the stables. Yes, to have all the softness of the sultanate scrubbed away, as the queen thought, but I had absolutely loved it. Obeying, submitting, that is what I'd found hard in my service under Queen Eleanor, and that is what I'd learned in the sultanate. But being harnessed, with one's arms bound tight to one's back, with a bit in my mouth, that had made everything profoundly simple. And if only I'd been allowed a set of gold silk blinders, covering my eyes, covering my gaze, covering my tears, that would have made it all even easier. I'd loved being a pony. One didn't have to think, one didn't have to submit. It was all done for me. As I inspected these men now, I could see they loved it. Nipples were painted in gold, and even their lips stretched over the gold bits, and in their navels were bright red garnets. Yes, red and gold. And never once, any more than soldiers at attention, did they acknowledge my inspecting gaze.
"Now this is Caspian," said the captain, embracing the pony nearest him with his right arm. And there was the old affection he'd showed to us so often, embracing us, crude as we were. "The king never rides out with a team without Caspian or Bastion."
And Caspian shivered all over as though he loved it, his blonde hair gleaming with the dusted gold. Even his eyelashes were tinged with gold. Bastion was also fair, though his hair was darker, and he had a thick fleece of chest hair as well, surrounding his gilded nipples and jeweled navel. He too seemed supremely happy and eager to run, pawing the ground in a stylized way that I'd learned so well long ago. The captain kissed Caspian's face, and I could see Caspian smile in spite of the bit, and then the captain's large hand, the hand that had struck me so many times, closed over Caspian's right buttock and squeezed it hard. Only now did the waiting grooms, all young men, with those straps in their hands, look a little restless.
"And you'll notice that all have been well paddled to make their pretty hindquarters blush," said the captain in a smooth, slow voice,
tentative, gauging my reaction. "Yes, I see that." I walked back slowly along the row. They were all red indeed, and their thighs had been spanked as well.
"That's how the king demands it," said Alexei. "Ponies are under strict discipline. I believe all are strapped every morning and evening, regardless of how they perform." "It keeps them in condition," said the captain.
Again his voice was gentle, not that commanding voice of old. But I knew that voice still lived in him, like a lion ready to spring. I could feel it.
"Now, this second set of four," said Alexei, "these two are dedicated ponies like Caspian and the others. Are they not?"
"Yes. Absolutely," said the captain. "The king loves them.
But when we get now to this third row, well, these are punished ponies. Little boys who have been placed in the king's team to learn humility and dignity. And here you'll see the wet eyes and faces. This fourth row are very bad little boys. Boys who've only just worked themselves up to the last row of the king's teams. The king has several teams, after having pulled refuse carts in the village.
Refuse carts?
Yes, those I recalled very well. The captain's hand went out again to squeeze the backside of one comely blonde-haired boy who was obviously struggling to conceal his sobs. Why had I not seen this earlier? The captain had a napkin out to blot the boy's cheeks. The soft sound of the muffled sobs ignited my blood.
"Now that's enough of that, Henri," he said. "Stand up straight."
The captain lifted the short, thick strap that dangled from his belt, unhooked it, and smacked the thighs of the pony hard several times, making him dance as if he knew what was good for him. Not to dance would have only incited more blows. You learn that fast when you're a pony. You can't speak, but you can respond, and that is what Henri did. But I could see the dignity in him. His cock was hopelessly hard in its lacings, held up straight with his scrotum laced close to it. He would go slack as he trotted. That couldn't be helped. But he'd be expected to be hard quick enough any time the coach stopped. My own cock was hopelessly hard, too, and I realized, of course, what this entire afternoon was going to be like for me, the pure torture of it. It would be like the torture of old, enduring for hours, even for those of us whose cocks were released 3 and 4 times a day. I felt a low churning excitement inside me, something savage suddenly, something so familiar yet alien that I stood there in silent musing, allowing it to collect and to seek some definition for itself.
"Later on, perhaps, we'll go to see the stables," said Alexei. "They're quite beautiful now. I never saw the stables of the village until this year. I never knew the village."
He didn't say this with pride or spite, because I had known both. He said it simply.
"Yes, I would love to see them," I said.
We mounted the chariot, the captain in the middle, Alexei on his far right, and I on his left, and he started the team. To my astonishment, the grooms ran along 2 on each side of the team, and began at once to whip the legs of the ponies. It was a comfortable trot, nothing fast, but I could feel the smooth power of the immense team and the fine spoke wheels of the chariot moving over the stones. I couldn't take my eyes off the men, how proudly they held themselves, seeming not even to flinch as they were whipped. But then the whipping obviously wasn't hard, and it was done with flat straps that made a noise. It would sting, yes, and I could feel that. Each of the 4 grooms had 4 ponies to drive, 2 in front, 2 behind, and now I could hear the groans and swallowed sobs of the punished ponies closest to us. I felt the blood drain from my face. This was the old road, I recognized it, that carts had once taken to the castle. It had been a dull and dreary road then, never used by the queen or her courtiers. But now it was a great curving and gently sloping thoroughfare, lined on both sides by banks of flowers. It must have been entirely rebuilt and regraded. Again, the sharp memory of the day I'd been taken down to the village came back, as if it were happening now, as if I weren't riding along beside the captain, a guest of the court, as if I were that naked slave in the cart with the other disgraced ones. And it had been that other captain, the captain of the castle guard, who'd whipped us fiercely as the cart rolled on. I hadn't tried to hide in the crowd from his lash. I'd failed so miserably at the castle that I'd been almost glad to be going to the village. They wouldn't expect anything of me, I thought. They'd only punish me. Wicked old Lord Gregory, in his 50s then, had told me over and over what the Queen might do to me if I didn't improve, and I'd been glad to get away from him. As we rounded the bend, I saw the great castle in all its breathtaking glory. It seemed its grim towers had been washed clean somehow, and they shone in the sun as if cased in limestone. We were beyond the garden walls, descending very gradually towards the village. Somewhere up there, inside those towers and wings, old Lord Gregory still presided over trembling slaves, or so Alexei had written to me. Wicked Lord Gregory, always angry,
always striking terror in the hearts of the most playful slaves.
"Prince, you see that all this has been replanted," said the captain of the guard. "As this is now a thoroughfare which the king and queen and courtiers travel all the time."
"It's very impressive, captain," I said.
"That road there leads off south to Prince Tristan's manor house, and on to the other new manor houses." "Oh, you must see them," said Alexei. "Tristan has his own little court. He spends his days writing, just as Lord Nicholas once did. He has become the new court chronicler."
At last I could see the walls of the Queen's village up ahead, or what was now called the Royal Village. How we had all cried and moaned in the cart that awful morning, and how the sight of the battlements had terrified me, even though I'd been glad to be free of the angry Queen and the angry Lord Gregory.
"I'll take you around the village," said the captain. "It's quite large now. The walls have been extended and will be extended more in the future, and many live outside the walls, as it is quite as safe to live outside as it is to live within."
"Yes, I should like to see it," I said softly. My eyes fell on the ponies again, all the tossing heads, and the jingling bells and the jewels flashing. I remembered the feel of the plug in my anus, the feel of the horse's tail brushing my naked legs, the feel of the harnesses holding me so firmly. It had been so simple. I'd wept only because it was expected that I weep, as bad little boys should when made into ponies, and I could still remember the anticipation I felt when the day was over, that I'd be whipped hard, and then some hot, wet mouth would come to ease the torment of my cock, and I'd be able to sleep in my stall, standing up, bent over at the waist, my head on a pillow of straw. My backside had been so toughened by then I could take the longest whippings or paddlings. Suddenly we were on the flat plain before the gates of the village, and then taking the road to the west around it. I could see soldiers up on top of the walls, and many farmhouses now in the mown fields. The road was broad and well beaten, and again there were flowers blossoming everywhere, and great shady copses of old trees. And now I saw the old spectacle of naked slaves working in the fields, tossing seed from baskets they carried, and other slaves laboring along the road, some pulling little carts full of fresh goods, driven by a solitary master with a switch. But I soon came to see that these weren't ordinary farm fields as they'd been in my time. No, everywhere I looked, I saw the crop was now flowers of various sorts, and in the distance I could see the shining glint of glass hothouses, no doubt for more tropical or delicate blooms. Slaves were doing the work as before, but I sensed even from the distance of the road that they seemed spirited and contented in what they were doing, tending the rose bushes, or the great patches of lilies. And I even saw two naked slaves obviously chatting with one another, but then a busy master did appear with the inevitable strap. Nevertheless, much had changed indeed. After my time as a village pony, I'd been sold off to a farmer who lived in the village for more punitive service, and I remembered pulling a small plough through the fields. It wasn't back-breaking labor, not at all, and though I came to hate the tedium of it, and the mud and the inevitable sweat, and my feet deep in the soft earth, I had loved the fresh breezes and the great open blue sky. Once again a flood of memories came back to me, of being driven by the strap to work on the farm, and then back to the village, where I was often strapped outside the door of the farmer's narrow house, with my hands tied over my head to an iron bracket for the evening. I was turned facing out when the strapping was over, barefoot, soiled, thirsty. An old scholar often came by to chat with me, though why, I never knew. He'd tease my cock, as so many other passers-by did, considering it their duty to keep the cocks up and down the street hard. And the old scholar, who was really no older than I am now, and rather elegant, told me that we naked slaves at the doorways were like the Herms of ancient cities.
"And what in the world, sir,"
I had asked one evening,
"is a Herm?"
"In old Athens they were pillars, young man, outside of houses, with the head of Hermes atop them, and cock and balls carved in relief. They were sacred, and they were for luck."
Then he had recounted an old story of how frightened the Athenians were when, the night before their fleet went out to fight a great war, all the Herms of the city had been vandalized. He thought the whole thing very interesting, and explained in depth to me how we naked slaves, almost all male, were exactly the same sort of sacred creatures, meant with our prominently displayed genitals to turn away harm. Some Herms had the head of Athena, he told me, and from these old statues had come eventually the word hermaphrodite. I'd been fascinated, uncomfortable as I was there, exposed and being teased idly by him, and helpless and listening as he took his time to tell me things of which I'd never dreamed. I had no inkling then that this was something I would never forget. I remember only that my cock did jump at the thought of a pillow with the head of Athena and a cock and balls, and I had been quiet to encourage him to go on talking, which he likely would have done even if I'd gone to sleep. I was shocked out of my reverie as there loomed into view one of the village pony teams, in their simple leather, pulling a large wagon full of people. As it lumbered past us on the left, I scarcely had a moment to drink in the spectacle of the struggling male ponies, with their heads bowed, their boots dusty, and their black horsetails gleaming in the sunlight. Again, the sight of the rippling muscles went to the root of my being, and only as the cart moved on did I realize the passengers were bowing to us. I had served in the village 2 full years before Lexius was brought up on fearful charges, and, well, by then I don't think the Queen so much as remembered me. And when she let me go, a while after Lexius and Alexei, it had been with a careless wave of her hand. Oh, that one, the clumsy boy. Send him home, too. No wonder my brother's first words to me, after all the years, had been, "What are you doing here?" There came other carts now laden with flowers, pots and baskets of flowers, and male slaves struggling as the farmer alongside swung his lash. Did they envy our ponies in their splendid and glittering trappings? I felt the captain of the guard's left hand on my shoulder suddenly. He was embracing me.
"Forgive me, Prince. You do look pale," he said.
4. For an hour we walked around the village, the three of us, Alexei as fascinated as I. We were to meet Lady Eva at the punishment shop, he told me.
"Do you know what that is?"
I laughed. I couldn't help it. I glanced at Captain Gordon, who had a remarkably serene smile on his face.
"Yes, Alexei.
I was sentenced here for 2 years. I know what the punishment shop is." I didn't bother to add that my master, the farmer, hadn't wanted to spend the money to send me there, but had done so just to keep up appearances, now and then, and to please his wife. She had been the anointed warrior of the household, and felt I just wasn't whipped enough. So we would sit there now as patrons of the establishment, would we? I couldn't quite wait. But it was the place of public punishment I wanted to see above all else. As for the village itself, it was splendid now beyond imagining, with all facades freshly painted in shades of Roman red or olive green, or deep ochre, and brass door knockers galore. The streets were so thronged with gentlefolk that I could scarce see the slaves adorning the open doorways, or working busily inside parlour and shops. What astonished me was the new cleanliness, the lack of the old familiar smell, and the glitter of gold everywhere, as people bought the rich wares on display at every turn. We moved all too fast through the huge fountain court of the inns, as far as I was concerned. I'd never been inside any of those august establishments, but Princess Beauty had told much of her time under the thumb of Mistress Loxley in one of them, as we lay in our golden cages in the hold of the Sultan's ship. Captain Gordon had kept rooms at Mistress Loxley's inn, and Beauty had first been given to him there.
"And where do you live now?"
I asked, as if I'd been talking, not thinking, and though my question startled him, he answered politely enough.
"I have a townhouse now, Prince, that His Majesty has given me. I'm grateful. It's more comfortable than any lodgings I've ever had."
As we walked on, finally, to the place of public punishment, he pointed out the house, a narrow but grand 3-story building, which had once been the house of Nicholas, the Queen's chronicler, and his sister. I remembered the Queen's chronicler. He'd been a dreary, miserable man during my years here, as he'd lost Prince Tristan, whom he loved with all his soul. He was held up to ridicule, but in whispers, as someone who had been foolish enough to ruin his heart on a slave. I knew now that Tristan had eventually returned to the kingdom. Alexei's letters had mentioned this, and so had the letters from the king. Tristan had his own fine manor house, and the king had indicated that I might want such a place of my own. At last we came to the great fairgrounds that I'd been thinking about since news of the new kingdom had come to me. I stood still as we left the paved street that had led us here, so that I could take it all in. It was the very same, yet utterly transformed. The old beaten earth was gone, and the stone paving went on forever, and once again it was swept and clean. To the far right I saw three of the great maypoles, with the slaves tethered to long leather ribbons by their necks, forced to run in circles by those handsomely dressed grooms in special village livery, it seemed, who paddled them, and as before, the wheels to which slaves were strapped, spread-eagled, who might be turned upside down by a patron for a small coin. It was not the worst of punishment by any means, but it was frightening, and I had known it in my last 6 months, but I had been a very different slave by then from the one first brought here in terror and shame. The slaves squealed and cried as the giant wheels turned, males as well as females, and of course the patrons teased them with little whisk brooms as they had in my time, but these now looked not so much like improvised or household tools, but like gaily beribboned trinkets sold here for the purpose, and I soon saw that they were. A slave, forced to squat and walk behind a peddler, carried two full baskets of such brooms for sale, on a long pole. And all over, everywhere, were the bright striped tents. Tents, as I knew, for having one slave bathed. Tents for having a slave, male or female, for a small payment. Tents merely to look, or to watch, or to spank. But novelties had been added, or so it seemed. I saw a booth where female slaves were kneeling on a shelf, their hindquarters bared, of course, to the crowd, who bought 3 and 4 yellow balls at a time to hurl at them, to see who might strike the heart of the target, which was, naturally, the anus of the slave. The backsides of these unfortunates were painted with brightly coloured target stripes, in what seemed like a thick adhesive paste, and I soon saw that some of the balls stuck to the targets in question, and the players argued spiritedly about who was better than whom in scoring at the game. Seemed obvious enough to me. As we walked about, we came to the rear of this tent, where I saw the heads of the bent-over slaves, fixed into a long yellow-painted wooden pillory, faces down, hands clenching and unclenching. I wondered, did it hurt much when the ball struck one's backside? Likely not all that much. Again, it wasn't the worst punishment for a slave, but I knew those subjected to it would feel a thrilling shame, nevertheless. Variety was the spice of the kingdom.
"I heard this was a very dusty place and rather crude in the old days," said Alexei. "I only saw it once before the king and queen came." "Well, that was true," said Captain Gordon, "but truthfully, my lord, lots of the court came down here just to see it from time to time, though they didn't let on to the old queen. It was supposed to be for the common people only, but look at the crowd now."
He was right. The area was milling with all manner of persons, from the finest and most ornately dressed to the simplest. But I could see that the gentry outnumbered the simple folk. Yes, gaily dressed village boys and girls were lined up before the tents with their coins ready, but plenty of the richer men and women regarded this as a feast for the eyes. I saw dark-haired Prince Roger moving through the crowd. No mistake, it was he, whom I'd briefly known in my time in the village, but he did not see me, and I did not feel moved now to speak to him. That would occur naturally enough later on. And it was larger, all of this, much larger. Only now, as we moved through a field of high tents, did I see the public turntable coming into view. Like all else, it had been refurbished and ornamented. No more the crude wood ladder up which slaves had been driven to be paddled, but now there was a gilded stair. The great turntable itself was trimmed in dagged leather of many colours, and the great whipping master himself, who had always been a rotund and crude fellow, with rolled-up sleeves and bulging arms, was now in a smart livery of grey and yellow, like all the grooms who paddled the maypole slaves and pushed and directed other slaves all about. But the whipping master was nevertheless a huge man, and I could hear the rumble of his deep, laughing voice from where I stood. He had a head of long, flowing hair and enormous shoulders. There was a row of unfortunates lined up to be paddled for the crowd on one side, and on the other an endless row of gilded wooden pillories, where slaves would be taken after their whippings to be displayed, bent over from the waist. A huge burst of collective laughter erupted from the tents behind us. I turned, and only then realized that indeed I was near dizzy, my senses flooded with scents, sounds, and sights. The captain steadied me again, but very respectfully.
"Dmitri, we don't have to remain here," said Alexei.
"Oh, but I want to see it,"
I said.
"Well, you'll see it's changed," said the captain softly, and he kept his firm hand on my arm.
I didn't mind it. I didn't care. My cock was like a brick in my trousers, and I felt my nipples tingling and burning inside my shirt.
Herms, hermaphrodites.
I heard the voice of the scholar.
"An ancient idea of an ideal creature who combined the traits of male and female."
"Here, my lord," said the captain, "drink this wine."
"The last thing I need in this sunshine,"
I said.
"It's weak, but it's very cold."
I did drink it. In a daze, I saw a slave girl before us with a pitcher, and I knew that she had offered the cup. Hair the color of copper flowing over her shoulders. Such a wealth of it. She seemed scarcely to be naked. If I'd been her master or mistress, I would have tied up her hair. Her breasts were plump and delicious, but pink, as though they'd been gently spanked or whipped. I saw she had a phallus tucked into her with a large crest of flowers positioned right in front of her pubic lips, the whole held in place by thin straps leading to a belt that circled her waist. How did I know there was a phallus there, hidden inside of her? I could tell by the way she twitched and moved, even as she stood still, her face flooded with a lovely blush, and her eyes glazed. She looked shyly at me as she refilled the cup.
"That is good,"
I said, as I drank another deep gulp. There came more laughter from the tents behind us.
"Oh, those games," said Alexei.
I didn't want to see that now, though I knew I would want to see all of the tents later. I wanted only to see the turntable, and the captain, I realized, suddenly was blocking my view. I stepped around him. The crowd was thickest near the turntable, possibly some 15 or 20 deep before it thinned out. There had been a break in the entertainment when we'd arrived, but the whipping master now motioned for a lovely princess or lady or little girl to come up the carpeted and gilded steps, and she did, sublimely flustered and blindingly succulent with rounded ivory limbs. The whipping master, even with his grey and yellow livery, wore a great leather apron, but it was worked all over with gilding and yellow designs against a grey background. The paddle in his hand was as I remembered, large and wooden, but it too was covered now in gold, and as he turned it this way and that for the roaring crowd, I saw that one side of the paddle was studded with what seemed tiny pearls. The other side, thankfully for the shivering little girl, was smooth. She had to kneel, just as we had knelt, free, over from the waist, with a small square pillar to support her chin. The pillow was carved and polished, and had its share of gold worked into it, and there appeared to be a little cushion of some soft red stuff on the top, not just the grainy wood. I pressed closer, but not too close. I didn't want the men and women to block my view. I was back far enough where I might see all. The little girl obeyed the whipping master submissively and almost gracefully, at once clasping her hands in the small of her beautifully arched back. Her little hindquarters were exquisitely displayed, and no one came to bind her calves to the floor. Her little upturned face was very red, however, and her eyelids were fluttering. How I remembered my eyes being so tightly shut that first time, and yet they had kept opening, no matter what I did, no matter how many times I'd closed them, opening as if I had to see the crowds as well as hear them, the hundreds of people gathered there as they were gathered around now. A liveried groom stepped up with a large bowl in his yellow-gloved hands. Out of the bowl, he scooped a thick cream, which he now applied to the hindquarters of the quivering girl, vigorously rubbing it into her flawless skin. The whipping master had wavy white hair and a florid complexion, and he cried out something I couldn't catch that made the crowd roar. He placed his large, meaty hand on the girl's neck, her soft, long bronze curls spilling down in front of her on either side of the pillar, where her chin rested. Then down came his merciless paddle, with the smooth side towards the girl, and he spanked her thigh so hard that he lifted her knees off the wood. The crowd cheered and clapped. One blow after another came at the girl in the same way, lifting her, forcing her up and off the wood, and letting her drop again, until finally she all but lost her balance and sank to the boards. I could hear the dark rumble of the man's voice, but not what he said. The girl scrambled to regain her position, and for the first time, by means of his foot pedal, the man spun the turntable to give the crowd to the far right a good look. Then back again, he turned her, as he was obviously right-handed, and down came the paddle again.
"Prince,"
the captain whispered. It was a shock, hearing his voice. I realized that I had put my hands to my lips.
"Quiet, please, captain."
"Not now," I said.
A woman's voice near me said, "Captain, he wishes to watch."
On went the spanking on the turntable, the girl's tears flooding, but she did not break form. She couldn't keep her calves still, or her feet. She was dancing, as they call it. She couldn't help it, dancing, but her little knees stayed in place. The table was spun again and again. The crowd was counting the blows aloud now and clapping loudly in time with each one. It was a fierce paddling, and the whipping master was loving it. And I knew what the girl was feeling. I knew how time had stopped for her, how the very concept of time was now beyond her reach. But I was awestruck at her control and her form. Memories paled and vanished in the bright glare of her perfect ivory skin, her little fingers twisting, but her hands never breaking form, and her sweet, delicate face awash with glistening tears. I could scarcely breathe. Suddenly the whipping master raised the paddle and turned it. Now the darling little bottom would get the prickly pearls. The crowd cheered. The pearl-encrusted wood spanked her, and she jumped helplessly, and I thought I heard a high squeal come from her, but in all the noise I couldn't be sure. The crowd loved it, and random clapping broke out all over. Far off to my right I saw Prince Roger watching, with a handsome lady beside him.
"And how many of you," I whispered under my breath, "wish you were up there in her place."
No one could hear that faint whisper, or so I prayed. But in truth, I didn't care. My memories for the moment were not present. I saw only her, jumping, dancing, struggling, but never breaking form. Her breasts shivering, such tender breasts shivering. The nipples of my chest felt like they'd explode with heat. My cock might have come if I'd dare to move and risk its rubbing against my clothes. It was over. Now would come the part, I feared, that I truly loathed. But it didn't happen. As she knelt shivering and sobbing, the crowd threw only gold coins at her, pelting her with them from all sides. She was lost in a rain of glittering coins. There was no refuse as there had been in my time. None of those rotten apples and eggs or bits of potato or cabbage pitched at her. I felt myself weak suddenly with relief. I hadn't come, no, of course not. But my body had relinquished the heights and was settling down. My nipples throbbed and my legs were weak.
"They don't heave their garbage at the slave anymore," I blurted out.
"No, that's not done now," said the woman who was near me. "The king did away with that. He thought it vulgar and unnecessary, and filthy as well. But anyone can buy a little gilded wood tokens for a half penny to throw, and many do."
I glanced to my left to see her standing beside the captain, one of those superb, truly red-haired women who have clear, blemish-free and creamy skin. She was very young, and her fashionable gown revealed the fullness of her magnificent breasts exquisitely. Her green eyes were large and brilliant in the sun, and her lips were rouged. A peerless beauty, dressed in gaily printed silk and gold with glistening silk balloon sleeves. Even her slippers were gold, glinting in the sun.
"Let me present Lady Eva, Prince," said Alexei.
"Ah, yes, my pleasure, my lady," I said, but I kept glancing back to the turntable, and the incomparable Lady Eva gestured for me, please, to continue watching, and so I did.
The little doe on the turntable was lifted now by her wrists, the whipping master twisting and turning her, as if she were on the auction block, for all to see her punished bottom and legs. Her waist was small and her hips shapely, but then all of her was shapely, even her writhing fingers, and her breasts, though smaller than those of many slaves, were finely shaped. The whipping master smacked her again, forcing her hips forward,
and she obviously cried out, though I couldn't hear it. But she was as dainty and graceful as ever, her head almost demure as she bent it to one side, her shimmering hair tumbling beautifully down, her eyes modest and half-closed. How unlike, in every conceivable way, she was from the clumsy, struggling prince I'd been on the turntable long ago, time after time, to the frustration of the captain of the guard.
"You do realize you'll be paddled here 4 times a day if you don't stop struggling, don't you?"
he'd whispered in my ear that last night. A liveried groom, the very same who had prepared the girl's hindquarters for spanking, rushed around gathering up all the tokens and coins. They were pushed into a little velvet sack, and this was tied about her neck. "You see, the king will not allow anything soiled to be forced into the slave's mouth," said the young woman at my elbow. "In the old days, they put the sack in the mouth, did they not?"
"They certainly did," I said, "or in our backsides in the punishment shop."
"Well, that is not done now either," she said without hesitation. Her voice was warm. It seemed all the voices of this realm were warm, but she spoke with an easy serenity that was a marvel. Lady Eva. I was struggling to remember some context for her name from the letters that I'd received, but a riot of memories was pressing in on me again. It was all tangled. I felt myself naked, sore, crying, being rushed to the pillory, just as I watched the dainty, accomplished little slave being rushed down the steps and thrust over and forward, her head and hands locked securely as mine had been locked. Gilded wood, of course. Wood decorated with curlicues and white flowers. And this, a pillory in the village. One out of an endless number. But her little head was the finest flower. Forgetting my manners, my friends, and the gracious lady beside me, I strode quickly through the loosening crowd and towards the distant pillory. I came up before her. Blue scarf. Wine. There it was again, those long-ago moments, as I was pilloried after each paddling. The captain of the guard had been so cross with me by sundown.
"You are learning nothing, prince."
I'd been so thirsty, and every time there had been the village girls with their cups of wine or cider or even milk, sweet white milk. She sobbed uncontrollably. Before I could turn and look for it, a tall, slender male slave appeared beside me with a pitcher and a cup. "My lord, she can only lap it from the cup or your fingers," he said, as I shoved the coin into the leather purse he wore around his neck. Even his cock was half-hard, his balls bound up tight to it, and the thin gold straps decorated with jeweled rosettes.
"Yes, I know that, little boy. Believe me," I said.
I held the silver cup under her face, and dipping my fingers, I moistened her quivering lips. But she was far too distressed to drink. I reached into my tunic pocket for a handkerchief, and mercifully found one with which I wiped her face and her eyes and her nose. Blue scarf. At sundown, after that third paddling, there had been the prettiest boy comforting me.
"Prince, you'll learn,"
he'd confided in a shy, halting voice. And now the dish was silver, and the wine was sweetened with honey. I could smell it. This was wonderfully comforting to her. She glanced up fearfully and then down, then stared at the buckle of my belt, or at the cup I held in my right hand. Now, when I fed her the wine with my fingers, she lapped at it, and then I let her lap from the cup itself.
"What is your name, little blossom?"
I said.
"Barbara, sire,"
she said through her sniffles and sobs.
"You were splendid on the turntable, Barbara," I said.
"But, sire, I was so clumsy, I..."
"Ah, precious. Never contradict your betters," I said.
"That will never do. Thank me, if you like.
But do not tell me I am wrong."
Her hair was almost golden in the sunlight, but truly brown, a light shimmering brown.
"Yes, sire, forgive me."
She jumped suddenly, and behind her, over the gilded pillory, I saw the boys and girls gathered there screaming with laughter. They'd been stroking her sex with those wicked little broom toys. I put up my hand ominously, and to my astonishment, they backed away. Why did this surprise me?
"Listen, Barbara, you are very beautiful," I said. "I adore you. I have come many miles to revisit this place.
I shall never forget you as the tender blossom I saw here during these moments.
I'm so glad you're pleased, my lord,
she cried. Crisp articulation. A well-spoken girl. Look up at me. Go ahead. Her eyes were dark blue, and I could see her piquant nose and mouth. A ruddy, finely shaped mouth. I shifted the cup to my left hand and felt of her little chin. More flesh than bone. I pressed my thumb into the soft flesh. There was a dimple there, very pretty, beneath her lower lip. One should not say eyes are intelligent, but she had intelligent eyes. To whom do you belong, girl? I asked.
To the village, sire,
she said, and her tears came again, thick and glassy and catching the sun.
I've only just...
Go on, little sparrow, I said.
I've only just come to the kingdom.
More tears.
I want so to please, my lord. I sold all I possessed to come here, my lord.
I turned. The captain was standing right behind me with Alexei and the lovely lady to whom I'd been unforgivably rude. But she seemed entirely patient and was smiling at me rather wistfully and said at once,
What can I answer for you, prince?
The girl. I want her, I said. Arranged, said the captain, whenever and wherever you like.
I know what I want now, the sort of lodgings if I'm to stay. I must talk to the king and queen.
And I will make certain of the details, said the lady eagerly. Only tell me, prince, and I'll see to it for you. I know full well that the king and queen very much want you to stay.
Yes, most definitely. They want you to stay, said Alexei. No doubt of it at all.
A townhouse, here in the village, I said. Is there a well-appointed townhouse that actually overlooks the place of public punishment? That's what I want, and of course we'll pay for it. And this girl, as my slave. I turned to offer the shuddering little damsel another drink. I knew she had heard every word. Her pink tongue darted gracefully into the wine, lapping as swiftly and skillfully as that of a cat. Indeed, there was something quite feline about her allure. This would certainly shape the manner in which I kept her, trained her, used her. I was now hard, and again on the verge of coming. I looked around, and I could see the distant windows and roofs surrounding the place. Surely those were the diamond-paned windows and gabled roofs of townhouses. Had to be, all smartly painted, but they were some distance away.
There is an available townhouse near, perhaps?
Asked Lady Eva, looking up at the captain.
Oh, yes, several, though they are hardly the finest or the most popular, said the captain. Most people think the place too busy, too noisy. Prince, you do realize the place is almost never quiet now. There are so many coming and going.
Doesn't matter, I said. It's precisely what I want.
I'm thinking which one would be the best, said the captain.
He gestured to what appeared the broadest of the distant townhouses, the last one in the row that partially enclosed the far side of the square.
I think that one is indeed available, used now for guests who come and go.
We can have it appointed beautifully for you, my lord, said lovely Lady Eva.
Yes, that one, I said. It looks down here on the turntable and the pillory.
I'm sure I can arrange all of this immediately, said the captain. The visitors in that house left early this morning for their native land.
He turned to gesture for someone behind him. Lady Eva volunteered that she would oversee all the amenities herself.
Dmitri, are you certain? Asked Alexei. You don't want to be in the castle with us?
Alexei, darling, said the lady, I think our beloved king might be quite pleased with all this. He's eager to hear Dmitri's views of the village and this very place.
He feels it lacks innovation and expansive ideas, said the captain in a low voice. Yes, but not to live at court, Alexei persisted.
But of course Prince Dmitri would be living at court, able to ride up at any time.
I never actually lived at court when I was here, I said to Alexei. I could hear the poorly suppressed emotion in my voice, and I knew that these words were foolish. They offered no real explanation for my choice. I laughed suddenly, inexplicably. I held the cup in my left hand while I smoothed Barbara's hair with my right. I leaned over and spoke into her ear. "You're going to find me a very demanding master," I said. "But fear not. When I'm finished with you, you'll be perfection, and I may just keep you for a very long time, ever driving you to greater heights."
"Master,"
she whispered, "I am Prince Dimitri." "Remember that name," I confided to her. "I'll be back for you. Perhaps not tonight, perhaps not tomorrow, but very soon." I turned to the captain. "There's no chance of my losing her with all of these people, all of these slaves."
"None,"
said the captain. I saw now that there were two grooms beside him, and they were eyeing the girl.
"All slaves are carefully watched. No slave is left to slip from vigilance. And actually, Prince, that was always true, even when the kingdom was one-third of what it is now."
Had I insulted him? Of course. He'd certainly stood over me on that first day here so many years ago, hadn't he? And we'd all known then that we were watched, accounted for, protected to be punished only in the approved ways. Again, I almost laughed, but why, I didn't know. The noise of the place rose around me, as if stirred by a latent breeze, and the sun felt a bit warm to me suddenly. Ah, it was these Russian clothes. I imagined myself naked, completely naked in this balmy air. Barbara had almost finished the wine, clever little creature. I took the last few droplets on my right fingers, and I pushed these against her tongue. Then I pushed my thumb into her mouth, opening it, feeling the hot, wet inside of her mouth. I wished I could see all of her and not this gilded pillory. Well, I would soon enough.
"Say it, girl."
"Prince Dimitri, my lord and master," she said,
her bright, dark blue eyes flashing on me again. 5. We were in the punishment shop, and what a grand tavern that turned out to be. "In old times," said the captain to Lady Eva, "these little places had been crowded and noisy with straw-strewn floors and cheap cider and ale." I knew this. I remembered. I remembered the farmer's wife sending me here on foot, alone, to be punished. We wore tags around our necks. The choice of tags suggested the punishment. A small black tag on a thin thong meant spank. A red tag meant spank severely, or so I'd been told. I'd always been sent with the red tag dangling between my nipples, hands clamped to the back of my neck, as that was the only way we'd ever been allowed to walk through the village on our own. And woe to the slave who wandered without a tag, a purpose, some emblem of intent from his master or mistress in sending him or her on an errand. The place had been narrow then, with a bare stage 4 feet off the floor, and crowded little tables where villagers drank their cider or ale, gossiped, and with some of the women knitting or embroidering with their little rings. Now it was vast, the beams of the ceiling painted with bright green vines and yellow flowers against a plaster blue sky. We had a polished table and carved chairs, and so did the other patrons, rich and poor, and the stage directly just in front of us, some 4 feet off the ground still, was painted and polished and draped in sumptuous wool hangings, and lighted with great multi-branching iron candelabra. The whipping master was caparisoned in yellow and grey, with the same ornate apron worn by his fellow on the public turntable, and if anything, this one was a more impressive figure in his high-backed armless chair. In the kingdom, always beware of armless chairs. He was a giant of a man with a mane of long flowing grey hair, and a broad beard, with rosy cheeks and big shining gold boots. He crooned to the slave bent over his apron now, tousling his hair and stroking his back and patting his upturned backside gently. The spanking had apparently just ended as we came in. He appeared to be comforting the victim and taking his time.
"He thinks he's a loving grandfather," said Lady Eva confidentially to me, as he might easily hear us, we were so close.
But the din was considerable. Everywhere, patrons drank their cider or ale and chatted with spirit, as if nothing, absolutely nothing, were happening on the stage.
"It's really too amusing," Lady Eva said to me with a brilliant smile. "That's why I've seated us so close.
You must hear and see this kindly father of Padling's for yourself.
Alexei laughed as he lifted his mug of mulled wine.
I love the man, he said. I come down here for this more than anything else.
More patrons pressed into the punishment shop now, and beyond the tiny diamond-paned windows, others were lined up to get in. There were villagers here. Ordinary people, yes. But it did seem to me the gentry was now the majority. So unlike the old times. The floor of the stage was carpeted in dark blue, and the whipping master's throne-like chair was placed on a carpeted platform, elevated above it by 1 foot. He had taken a little break for himself, it seemed, and drank from a flagon offered him by his liveried attendant. Yellow gloves. So many of the grooms and attendants wore yellow gloves. I saw the stool beside him, fancy and carved, as was every movable, and the pot of cream there, and a pile of what appeared to be more yellow leather gloves. The slaves were lined up on their hands and knees, on a long, easily sloping ramp to the far side from us, which brought them from a pen inside the front door to the stage. I remembered that ramp very well, making my way up it slowly, as it sometimes took an hour before my turn to be spanked severely, and hoping that the crowd would take no interest, which was often the case. After all, I'd known this place after my return from the Sultanate, and I had become a master of control. I didn't give them a good performance. I was far too resigned and polished, and even when told to wag my little tail, I did it too gracefully to interest the commoners who used to congregate here, more to see one another than to bother with us. I was eager for the show to begin, and felt oddly detached, even from Alexei, though the courtesy and sweetness of Lady Eva touched me. The captain had gone off to see to my townhouse and to the delivery of Barbara, along with all the furnishings and goods. I felt his absence, but I didn't know whether I was grateful for it. It seemed I missed him. I looked around the shop slowly, noting a multitude of changes, the dark blue painted walls, the polished floor. Ah, such polished floors. The ramp for the waiting slaves had its blue carpet, same as the stage. Tables were set with small silver lamplets or candles. Goblets, flagons, or cups were of silver or enameled earthenware, and the smell of the place was sweet from the honey and spices in the heated drinks. I came here many times, I murmured under my breath, principally to convince my companions that I was not altogether ignoring them, though in fact I was. A young gentleman had caught my eyes, a figure and face I thought I might know. He was my age, I had come to realize, though on first sight he'd seemed much younger, with an oval face and long red hair. It was slightly darker than Lady Eva's voluminous hair, and his eyes, though green, were paler than hers. But he was handsome in the extreme, and dressed fussily and finely in a long peach-colored embroidered tunic and soft, ornate Morocco leather boots. He wore the same heavy gold chain and medallion that Alexei wore, and I wondered at it. Then it hit me. Prince Richard, I said aloud. Alexei leaned forward, and quickly I explained. Richard had been in the village when I'd returned from the land of the Sultan, a prince who displeased the queen as much as I had, sent down to punishment, just as I had been, and he'd served the hard, demanding Mistress Jennifer Loxley at the inn. He'd left before I had, and now I could see he was back.
Oh, yes, said Lady Eva. That is Prince Richard, indeed. He returned 2 years ago, and the Queen was glad to receive him. He languished at court until the new King and Queen arrived. He's the guiding genius of this place, so to speak. The King relies upon him to oversee this and all the punishment shops, and he enjoys this very much. He lodges at the inn now where once he was a slave, but no one would recognize the inn now, for it's become a place of luxury for moneyed guests, and even nobility. He's devoted to our new monarchs. He especially adores the Queen, and takes the noon meal with her almost daily. He has lodgings at the castle as well.
Guiding genius. These were the words that the King had used in referring to the place of public punishment. And you, Alexei, I said, turning to him and pointing to his chain and medallion. Does this have to do with being the guiding genius of something? Is it permitted for me to ask? Naturally, and I'm glad to tell you, he said,
I'm in charge of evening court entertainments, along with Rosalind and Elena. The ladies wear a medallion linked to their belts, and often hidden in their pockets. I'm happy to wear this, as you see.
And Prince Richard's medallion indicates his responsibilities, said Lady Eva. The villagers and guests know by these medallions that they might approach him and ask questions, that he is ever ready to help. Prince Richard is the master of His Majesty's punishment shops.
I understood. I understood more than I could put into words. I understood everything. Of course, Prince Richard had been punished innumerable times over the years here. He knew the ways of the place intimately. He was the perfect person to refine and perfect it in the rush of conflicting forces that characterized any new kingdom, any new regime. Guiding genius.
Dmitri, said Alexei gently and confidentially, you need accept no such position, you know. You are entirely free to enjoy the kingdom. Prince Roger is back. Do you remember him? He has no task as yet, and may never seek for one. Tonight, you and other returnees will be presented officially, and that means welcomed. Welcomed as guests to court.
I know. I understand that, Alexei, I said, my eyes fixed on the stately, almost prim figure of Prince Richard. His arms were folded. He sat with his back to the ramp of waiting slaves. He was studying the patrons of the place, not the slaves, watching the naked serving boys and girls, watching the great red-cheeked whipping master laugh with his groom as he drank his ale.
Listen, Prince, said Lady Eva suddenly, I know you want to be alone with your thoughts here. I'll go on to see to your house. When you're ready to return to court, I'll have the king's chariot waiting for you at the village gates. Alexei, you can handle the team, can you not? Now I'll leave you.
We rose to bid her goodbye, and she took me boldly in her arms. Lady, you read my mind and my heart, I said.
I understand, my lord,
she said. You have only just returned. I cannot know what it is like for you. But I have seen what it has been like for others. She kissed me on both cheeks and made her way out of the place, quite independently, though I caught sight now of a groom who followed her, a groom in castle livery, who'd been waiting quietly on her all along. She knows much, I said to Alexei.
That's why she is in charge of all slaves in this kingdom, said Alexei. That's why the king and queen completely depend on her. As she admitted, she does not know what we know. She is very young and has never been anyone's naked slave, but her comprehension of this world we share is unsurpassed. Do you want me to go?
No.
I took his hand almost desperately.
Not at all.
A naked serving girl refilled my goblet, and a boy appeared with a fresh mug of mulled wine for Alexei. The whipping master drew himself up, wiped his heavy gray mustache with his enormous hand, and a little sprinkling of applause broke out here and there. His face shone bright in the candlelight. No doubt dusk was coming down in the crowded street beyond.
Come now, poor little piglet, he said to the slave boy who had been waiting his turn all this while, first on the ramp. Oh, is there no end to beauty here, I thought.
Piglet was the word often used in the village for a male slave, just as partridge was for a female. And this young man was a plump, pink piglet indeed, with deliciously shaped hindquarters and an exquisite face. He made his way on his hands and knees, with a very straight back and graceful fingers, up onto the platform, and then knelt up for the whipping master to take the dreaded red leather tag from his neck, which was tossed in a gilded basket to the man's far right.
Such an expression, said Alexei. What is he, do you think? 20?
Maybe, I said. And like a young god.
The boy had a marvelously well-proportioned face, with a narrow nose and large, sensuous, inviting lips. His chin was strong, and so were his shoulders, and his hair fell down on his shoulders, rather like that of Prince Richard, but it was pale yellow, perhaps much bleached by the summer sun. He glanced timidly at the whipping master with grey eyes, but there was no cowardice in him.
Now, what have you done, young Valentine? Said the whipping master, affectionately smoothing the boy's hair. Come now, youngling, tell the truth.
Why has your master sent you here again today?
Suddenly tears sprang to the boy's eyes. He kept his hands beneath his hair and clamped on his neck, but his chest heaved.
He is put out with me, sir,
he said under his breath, but I could easily hear him. No matter what I do, my hands shake. I spilt his ink. I dropped the bottle.
Well, you'll get over that, poor little brat,
said the whipping master, smiling.
You'll soon learn not to fumble at all.
He patted the boy again gently, first on his head and then on his backside. He kissed the boy's cheek.
Now you know I'm going to give you a sound spanking, don't you? He said, and that's going to help you to be a good boy. Spanking softens the soul.
He hugged and kissed the boy again, and then, with his left hand, pulled him forward by the hair until the boy lay over his lap.
Now you keep the cock well behaved, little fellow, he said, or I'll be spanking you all evening. You know that, don't you?
Yes, sir,
the boy said, and only now were the tears gathering. The over-the-knee position almost always brought tears, tears even from the most proud and mocking. The whipping master drew on a yellow leather glove and picked up a glob of fresh cream and worked this into the boy's hindquarters, lovingly massaging his thighs.
Such pretty, plump legs, muscular yet soft, he crooned to the boy. I have to confess, Valentine, paddling you is always a pleasure. Oh, I know you're going to be bawling in a minute, but you're such a little pork pie. So ripe, so pretty. Now you be a good boy, and you think on your faults with every smack.
Yes, sir,
said the boy again. I glanced at Prince Richard, so far away, sitting against the ramp. His eyes were fixed on the boy. Ink. The matter of ink put me in mind of that scholar who used to chat with me when I was a herm against the wall.
Now you pick up those balls of yours.